Now at Verizon, we're locking in low prices for 3 years guaranteed on my plan. And you can get a single line for just $45 a month when you switch and bring your phone. That's our best price ever on unlimited welcome with autopay plus taxes and fees guaranteed for 3 years. Because at Verizon, we got you. Visit your local Indianapolis Verizon store today. $20 monthly promo credits apply over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Price guarantee applies to then current base monthly rate. Additional terms and conditions apply.
Sometimes things get in the way. Big obstacles. Little setbacks. But you keep going. Through the grind. The long nights. With flexible pathways. Online, hybrid, and in-person. Indiana Wesleyan University gives you accessible tuition with world-class connections. Where there's a will, there's a way. And with Indiana Wesleyan, there's a way forward. Start today at discovertheway.com.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
Hello, I'm Dr. Hildebrand Lickbucket, and you are, your chart says, Ben Sternke. What brings you in to see me today?
I've had a cold, as you can tell from my voice. It's a little bit more baritone than usual.
Okay.
Listener, this is actually what my voice sounds like. I use no sound effects, but the mornings have been like this. I'm recovering from cold, and I got some gunk that my body's trying to get rid of.
I'm going to need you to disrobe and lay on the table.
I refuse to do that. I don't think you're a real doctor.
Ben, we've known each other and we've been living in proximity to each other for about 10 years now.
Uh-huh.
And this is the longest you've ever been sick.
It's true. I don't tend to get sick very much.
Right.
And I tend to get better real quick. So I wouldn't say I'm sick. Like I feel a lot better.
Okay.
I don't know. I just don't want... listener, you're not going to get a virus by listening to me.
But, Ben.
No, what I'm saying is, like, I'm over being sick, but this is, like, the recovery, the cough and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It is lasting a lot longer. And it was a long time sort of feeling sick, too. It kind of came in waves. It felt like about 5 or 6 days.
It was
not so good.
Yeah. And that now it's sort of settled into
my chest, right? And my nasal passages, sinuses.
Well,
so anyway, I'm coughing and sniffling and trying to get rid of all the gunk. Anyway, that's probably TMI for our listeners.
Yeah, well, I just could have done the exam, and you would already have a Z-Pack or I don't know, whatever, Cialis by now. I could have gotten you out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Lickety split. Listener, we've got a book club coming up in the Gravity Commons that we want to talk to you about. Ben's leading that. Ben, you want to share?
Yeah, I'm excited about this one. We're doing this at our local church as well. And it's a little bit of a change of pace. The previous books have been longer. I don't know. They've all been a little different. You know, we did The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory, which is kind of a journalistic tromp through Magaland. And then we did Lamb of the Free, which is a very dense theological look at what the Old Testament sacrifice system was all about and why our ideas about what Jesus' sacrifice on the cross is all about are mostly wrong because we've got the wrong idea about Old Testament sacrifice. Anyway, that was a good one.
Yeah.
This one is... a lot shorter and a lot simpler. It's Rowan Williams' book, Being Christian, and it's just 4 chapters, and it's a really interesting introduction to some of the most broadly practiced Christian practices, like across denominations, baptism, reading the Bible, taking the Eucharist, and praying. prayer. So those four topics in four chapters. And I think it's going to be helpful if you, like a lot of our listeners and a lot of the people in our community, have grown up with a version of Christian faith that doesn't really resonate with you anymore. Maybe, for whatever reason, you're just like, you know what? This isn't making sense to me anymore. This doesn't resonate with me anymore. And I think that the way that Williams writes, is in a way that helps us sort of be reintroduced to the essence of what these things mean. And I think it'd be a really helpful thing sort of after deconstruction, after some sense of disillusionment, to come back into and say, well, what is baptism all about? What is the Christian faith really all about? And is there a version of this that I can sort of embrace, or at least begin to get my head around and begin to practice again? Because I know for a lot of our listeners, like, reading the Bible is really triggering and really difficult. So what's that all about? And I'm excited. I really like the way that Rowan Williams writes in this book. It's very simple. It's very accessible. I'm hopeful that it'll be that kind of a book club for us.
All right. Don't leave us hanging. How would you, how do you sign up for this?
You can go to gravitycommons.com/book club, all one word, gravitycommons.com/book club. There's some basic information there about the book, a link for you to order it, and then also a form to fill out. So make sure you fill out that form. That will get us the information that we need to send you the information that you need. So there's a Zoom link. There's a schedule. This starts April 11th, by the way. April 11th, Friday. We're going to do it Fridays at noon Eastern time. That was the time that won in our little poll inside the Gravity community. And so, Fridays at noon, starting April 11th, 4 weeks. Real simple. It's a donate what you want kind of basis. So it's free to attend if you can't afford to donate right now, but we take any donations you can afford to make, just to make it continue to help the book club and the rest of Gravity's ministry be accessible to everyone.
Right. Yeah. This has been the highlight of my week for a while. If you're looking for community, you are feeling isolated, or you're looking for ways back into the faith, or you want to connect with people who you can trust. I mean, really, it's really hard to find Christian community right now for a lot of us. And I think what's happening in the commons and around these book clubs and learning communities that we have is really precious and special. So sign up, join us. If you sign up, you don't have to be there, but even if you miss, you get recordings and you can watch them or listen to them at your leisure.
Yep. A lot of people do that if they can't make the time.
Yeah. All right. Well, today we are going to be talking about mammon. You know, one of my all-time favorite topics. I should get a tattoo. You know,
I don't know why you love mammon so much. Jesus was really clear about loving mammon, loving God. So anyway,
I think it's more accurate to say. Long-term
project that I'm trying to get you off your love of mammon. Anyway, go ahead. Continue.
Just for that, your Z-Pack now is going to only be suppository. No oral antibiotic for you. We're talking to Stephen D. Morrison today. Who is a prolific American writer, probably best known for his ongoing multi-volume In Plain English series. So he's got a Karl Barth In Plain English and others. He's an ecumenical theologian, drawing inspiration from Karl Barth, T.F. Torrance, Jürgen Moltmann, James Cone, among others.
Wow.
Recently, he's been writing about political theology, and he joins us today to talk about his book, All Riches Come from Injustice: The Anti-Mammon Witness of the Early Church and Its Anti-Capitalist Relevance.
Woo!
Relevance. There it is.
Revelance.
Revelance.
Might be reveling in the anti-capitalism as well.
Anyway, let's get into this conversation with Stephen.
All right.
Stephen Morrison, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Excited to talk to you about this book. I read it last year and couldn't put it down. And it sat by my reading nook for a while, and I got like coffee stains on the cover. That's how you know I really spent some time with your book. Before we get there, though, tell us a little bit about yourself. Like, what are some of the key points, maybe of your spiritual journey that's led you into this place you are today?
Sure. Without going into too much detail, I guess, I grew up in the church, grew up in kind of a fairly conservative Methodist tradition, went to a charismatic school. I kind of have a charismatic background as well. And then kind of really started studying theology for myself and got really interested in a lot of different theologians, namely Karl Barth, T.F. Torrance, Jürgen Moltmann were kind of the big three for me early on. And so I didn't have any formal education for a while and just knew I kind of wanted to write and think about theology. And so I had some time to spend a lot of time reading. And so kind of found my way backwards into studying theology. And it was always in a way that theology was a direct passion and really an expression of the love of God, and which I still think of it today. I think that's, it's loving the Lord your God with your mind. And so, yeah, that was kind of my journey a little bit into it. And so I started writing about 10 years ago now. I've done mostly self-published stuff. I'm starting to do more traditional writing now. But just kind of the journey I went on with learning kind of different frameworks for thinking about God, frameworks for thinking about the world was a big catalyst for me in my journey, and definitely led to where I am today. I think it was the discovery of like Jürgen Moltmann and liberation theology through him that really launched me to where I am with this book now. But it also was really Karl Barth, who was an early socialist in his life and quite political, that kind of gave me the framework for thinking about my own faith and how it relates to the world and how it relates to other people and all of that. And yeah, it's still a journey I'm on, very much on. I'm mm-hmm. moving a little bit more towards academic work, where I still don't have a bachelor's degree, but I did attain a master's this past year. I actually published this book during my master's program, and am currently working on a doctorate focusing on Karl Barth. So, yeah. Yeah, it's been quite a journey, but yeah, that's the, I guess, trying to be condensed version of it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It's interesting how many people I know from the West, typically white people, who read Jürgen Moltmann and he's their entry into liberation theology. Mm-hmm. And how many people can read Karl Barth, or hear about Karl Barth for years and not understand that he was a socialist. And so part of what I want to chat about today is the ways in which our political theology or our political economies shape how we, what's important to us, how we see scripture, how we read scripture. And so maybe we can start then with just sort of getting some terms right. You know, your subtitle is the anti-mammon witness of the early church. And I wonder, I use that word a lot and people don't like it because they don't know what it means. And they tell me that we need to choose a different word if we're going to talk about whatever it is I want to talk about. And I'm like, well, Jesus chose that word. So let's talk about mammon. What do you mean by it? And why do Jesus and the early church have such a problem with mammon?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely an important word. I think several points with mammon that I think are relevant. It is unique to Jesus in the scriptures. And it's the interpretation I kind of arrived at through the help of some liberation theologians and others, that mammon really is set up in the New Testament, especially as a rival god. It's kind of it's the personification of wealth, obviously money, but it's painted as an either or, as either you serve God or you serve mammon, almost in the spirit of the second commandment, that you should have no gods before me. And so this kind of dichotomy is set up where it's an idol. It's this thing that becomes this alien power that now lords over us, that we've projected up as a false god. And so treating it as a rival god, I think, is quite helpful, because then it helps us kind of analyze the political systems of today and kind of arrive at this conclusion that this idolatry of wealth is this this systemic thing, this thing that it should, there's no other choice, but we can't make compromises with this. The only choice is to resist it as a rival deity and proclaiming that Jesus is Lord, not Mammon, is ultimately, I think, the expression of that. But it's also interesting because I think there's some unique ways that like some radical socialist thought has kind of taken that idea and run with it. And I think the example that's interesting that I've been thinking about recently, I talk about some in the book, but even more recently is how like Marx takes this idea of what he calls fetishism, which is quite similar in how he uses it to how the Bible talks about idolatry. And so he's constructing this entire argument about political economy and capital and how this is almost a demonic force that takes on a life of its own, where he'll talk about how basically every system within capital accumulation, within the processes of exchange and value, must bow their knee to this accumulation of capital at all cost. And so every actor in that economy has to basically give worship and sacrifice to Mammon. And so I think it's a really interesting connection between, you know, what the scriptures are saying and then obviously what a political theorist is talking about. Because I think it gives us language for talking about how the problem isn't necessarily just wealth as such, but it's actually this systemic aspect of it. And I think that's obviously kind of a constructive reading of what the New Testament is talking about when they talk about Mammon. It's quite short, and I'm making some leaps obviously within the constructive space for that, but I think it's a helpful language to then develop a robust like critique of these systems of domination that come from capital. And so I link the two quite closely together. I think that Mammon captures the spiritual dimension really well. But my goal in this book is very much to emphasize the systemic aspect of capital and Mammon, and to show it as truly a rival religion to Christian faith.
Yeah, I think that's, for me, that's part of the reason that it's helpful to say things like, you know, Mammon, to kind of use that word, because it does introduce, it seems to me that, you know, a lot of the writers that have written about Mammon, like one of its key features is it's hidden, the hidden nature of its power. Mm-hmm. We don't realize we're being used by it. It sort of seems inevitable or obvious that the accumulation of capital would be, that's good, right? You know, even though like we're starting to see all these sort of problems, you know, with it, you know, in late stage capitalism and, you know, the global, like we're going to burn up our planet because we're accumulating right. capital. Like we can't see the fact that sort of bowing down to this God is actually killing us. So I think it's helpful in that way. Related to this, you know, you're pretty clear in your book that both the scriptures and the early church, the problem that they have is not necessarily with abundance per se, that there's a, you know, Jesus came to give us life and more abundantly. So, and you know, the Garden of Eden had plenty of, so the problem isn't with abundance. The problem is with inequality. I wonder if you can expound on that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's an argument I make kind of building on some of the liberation theologians that I like. I mentioned Jose Miranda explicitly as kind of giving me this term called differentiating wealth. Because that kind of gives language to exactly that, that I think, because, you know, anytime somebody starts to critique wealth or rich people, there's always the pushback that says, oh, well, what about this figure in the Old Testament that had all this wealth or this figure in Christian history or something like that? And it's like, well, the problem isn't explicitly just having, you know, joy in the bountiful things of the earth or having things that make us comfortable. I mean, all of us, I guess I can speak for myself, but the three of us here, we're probably, I'm assuming, people that live in the West, and we're people that have a relative degree of privilege, and we have a roof over our heads and not necessarily worried that tomorrow we won't have anything to eat. And that by itself gives us tremendous privilege. And so I think what I was trying to do with some of that language was to say that we can also recognize how even though we take part in this system, that inequality as such is a severe problem. And because I think there's a kind of this disconnect of people that consider themselves middle class, that they don't want to critique wealth because they think it's critiquing them directly. It's like, well, I have privileges, I have a house, I own the X, Y, and Z. When I'm trying to push the argument a little bit more towards actually the problem is the fact that, you know, a handful of people own the majority of the power in society because they own the majority of the infrastructure, they own the means of production, they own the large conglomerates, and that inequality is really kind of the target, not necessarily abundance, because the early church talks about that some. It's about how, you know, the earth was created for all to be shared in common, and its abundance is good. The problem is when one person hoards more than their share, and other people are starving. And so I have a chapter about how they connect that with the doctrine of creation in really interesting ways. Some of the church fathers do that. And yeah, how it was this analysis of, you know, just the basic fact of obviously they're living in a little bit of a scarcity condition, which is slightly different than we are today. But I still think there's a connection to be made between inequality today and kind of what they were critiquing. But yeah, I try to push on that pretty heavily because I think because I'm conscious of that concern that I think people have, especially in the West. I mean, I'm somebody in the West. I'm, you know, live in America. The conversations I have with people typically around that was like, well, I make this amount of money. Do you mean me? It's like, well, not necessarily. Do you, you know, you, if you wake up on Monday morning, you go to a job and you take a salary, most likely you don't own that company. We're talking about the very, very, very large groups of people. And I start the book off saying that the statistic that 8 people own about 50% of the entire wealth of the planet. And that's from Oxfam. And it's an older study, but it's probably changed since then because inequality has only grown worse, as we've seen in a number of studies. And so it's that I'm talking about, not necessarily the people that have a vacation home or, you know, et cetera.
Right.
Because I one of the goal for that is to have solidarity amongst each other, that we can make a better world together. Yeah. And this kind of dividing us up into people that struggle against each other is part of the problem, where collective action, I think, is what we need to kind of solve some of these issues that we're facing, especially inequality.
We'll be right back.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying some new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing. More transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation. Let's get back to the show.
I think of that, you know, it's a picture that gets passed around the internet every once in a while. It's the kind of the rich old white guy with a pile of cookies on his plate, telling the sort of the white worker who has one cookie, pointing to the immigrant on the other side of the table and saying, I think that immigrant wants to take your cookie.
Yeah.
You know, and so the pitting of kind of people who are actually in solidarity with each other, if you just do the math, you know, in terms of like, you know, if you lost your job and would be in trouble within a year, like you're with 99% of the whole world, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so sort of overcoming the illusion that we're not in solidarity with one another and that we should be fighting each other, you know, and that, you know, on socioeconomic lines, but also on racial lines and all of that kind of thing. So anyway,
yeah,
you just, definitely. You got me, I guess I'm just preaching at this point. So
yeah, no, it's very true. Yeah. Cause I do think capitalism does a good job of trying to foster the solidarity with the very, very rich and powerful.
Yes.
Instead of, you know, we have to foster the solidarity with each other. And I think, yes. It does lead to, you know, some of those disconnects. There's always that phrase. I don't remember if I cite this in the book, but it's a phrase that gets thrown around a lot, which is you actually have more in common with the man on the street than you do have with the man in the penthouse.
Yes.
You know, most of us, a couple paychecks, a couple bad, you know, health scares that lead us into debt, that could very quickly lead us on the street. Whereas it would take almost something miraculous to end us up in a, you know, billionaire class status. Right. And so we actually, like you said, statistically, factually, we are more closely aligned with the people that are on the street, but we don't always feel that way because it's a little bit of a pride, obviously, plays into that. But I think recognizing that solidarity is such an important step.
Yes.
In working together towards resolving some of these issues, because my, you know, I can't. I've been thinking recently about this. There's this African philosophy called Ubuntu, which is "I am because we are."
Yes.
And I think about that a lot in terms of like I'm passing somebody on the street that's starving. I can't see that person as somebody alien to me. Right. Their struggle is also my struggle, and I have to recognize that we're in this collectively together, and I can't treat them as this other. I can't otherize them, but truly see my common humanity with them. And even as Christians, see them as Jesus Christ, as Christ amongst us, as the one that's on the street. And so, yeah, yes. I think that's super important.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to return to this. I mean, this idea or this concept of capitalism, I mean, mm-hmm. it's something we live in. And growing up as like a white Christian in America, you know, and there's a long history for this, capitalism is next to Christianity. Like you can't really critique capitalism without becoming an enemy, mm-hmm. without becoming unchristian in some ways. So maybe you could give us like a way of understanding, like how do you explain or understand capitalism? I guess mm-hmm. it's a definition. But then as you share that, maybe help us begin to understand why this political economy, this system of organizing our resources, is in tension or at odds with the scriptures and the early church?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a big question for sure.
Well, I mean, there's all kinds of ways to talk about capitalism, right? You could talk about it in a very abstract way, but maybe in relationship to, you know, the church father who says all riches come from injustice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do make a point to, you know, be clear in the book that I'm not suggesting that the church fathers had any concept of capitalism or that they knew this or in same as I think there's sometimes this fallacy where people go back and they say, oh, well, Jesus was a socialist. It's like, well, he really wasn't. You can't make that sort of leap. I think what he teaches in his context points to X, Y, and Z, anti-capitalism or socialism. But I try to clarify that. But I do think certainly that the wisdom that they have about their situation has extreme relevance for us today. And I think especially the empirical situation, like in the early church in Rome that they were in, has relevance. But yeah, it's hard to define capitalism very succinctly. I think I do understand it in sort of the Marxist lens. I talk about that in the book, kind of my, not necessarily apology for Marx, but certainly a sense where I think that Marx is a helpful figure for analyzing capitalism. I read Marx as not an ideological figure, but truly somebody that was trying to analyze scientifically the systems that we live in. And Marx was a Hegelian, and so he understood capitalism as a historical epoch, as a development in history. And I see it very much that way, that if we trace it back further into its roots with feudalism and all of that and how it developed into what it is now. And so I think that's important to add, because when I talk about capitalism and I critique it, I'm also conscious that it has produced and revolutionized in good ways. It's not necessarily a moral judgment. It's a judgment about that it's no longer necessary. Martin Luther King Jr. has this great quote where he says, capitalism has outlived its usefulness. I forget exactly how he phrases the rest of the part, but he says something about it takes the basically it takes the accumulation of wealth and gives it to the luxuries of the few instead of fulfilling the needs of the many. He says it better than that. But the first part is that capitalism's outlived its usefulness. And that does imply that at one point it was useful and it was helpful and it did industrialize a lot of things. And one of the things that even Marx points out is that it brought a lot of people together where now what was done individually by, you know, craftsmen and whatever else are now done collectively. But the problem with it is because there's this tension between private ownership and social effort. And so nothing's made by one person really anymore, but the wealth that's created by so many people collectively, all the hands that are making any number of things, whether it's, you know, an iPhone, a coffee maker, whatever, there's at least a dozen people that have had their hands on designing it, building it, putting it together, shipping it, whatever. So no product is ever made by one person, but capitalism funnels all of that profit into the hands of one or maybe five or six shareholders. And so that tension is one of the ones that actually Engels describes it quite well in one of his short books that is the fundamental contradiction within capitalism, that this tension exists between we own these things, we work on these things together, but the lion's share, the majority of the value that's created goes into one pot. And that inequality is such a tension. And so what Marx and Engels argue and realize is that it's a period of development that no longer is useful. It was useful in revolutionizing industry, but it needs to find that the Hegelian term of sublation, of sublating, of transcending that and resolving that tension with collective then ownership. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I think, how I kind of try to describe it. And then I think it is extremely relevant to how the early church talks about mammon, because they are hitting a lot of these same points. You know, funneling all this money into one or two hands is at the expense of the poor. Basil has this great quote where he says, if you own a second pair of clothes, you know, a second cloak, you owe it to the person who has none. And that kind of radical sense of interpreting the critique of mammon and Jesus in a way that has that arc towards you actually do owe something to your neighbor. You're not this kind of libertarian, egotistical individualist that has no obligations to the people around you. You're a co-human. You live in community and you actually do owe something to your neighbor. And I think that radically undermines some of the core facets of what capitalism does, which is very individualistic. You know, go and get yours at any expense of, you know, competing with your neighbor, and somebody else doing well is seen as competition against you. And so I articulate kind of that commonality theme and how that pushes, I think, in that direction in terms of how we would take the early church and apply it to our situation. Another one I bring up is the early church's very, very clear rejection of usury, which is the charging interest on a loan. Yes. And I think, I mean, we even see that with some of the economic issues today. Capitalism has become extremely financialized, where, you know, a lot of it's just speculation on numbers, no longer really grounded in reality. I think the example I think of is like Bitcoin and NFTs back when that was the thing. These are very speculative products that no longer have a grounding in reality. And that's because of kind of this financialization, and Capital Volume 3 talks about that some too. What I'm trying to do is take some of these kind of themes and these arguments that are in the early church in their context. And I think they're directly relevant to our struggle and our situation, as I would define capitalism in that way, as living within that tension of how we arrange the system. Is it serves capital accumulation at no other cost, and human lives are clearly affected by that sort of system where people don't have enough to eat. You know, America's a good example. We're so-called the richest nation on earth, but we have a serious problem with child hunger and potentially getting worse. Our homeless population is growing, and yet we're seeing record profits on the stock market, and we're seeing all of these things. And so it's clearly outlived its usefulness. And I think the wisdom of the early church clearly pushes us towards, we need to think more collectively and return to this commonality of the earth, that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. And because of that, it's given for the good of all, not for the good of the few. And so my short definition of capitalism is that it prioritizes as a system the luxuries of the few over the needs of the many. Whereas I think the Christian witness should be the opposite, that we need a system that prioritizes the needs of the many over the luxuries of the few. Not that there can't be luxuries, but we right. first have to take care of everybody to have enough to eat. There's kind of this meme that's gone around that I think articulates it well, where it's basically applying in economic terms the kind of cookout ethic of nobody gets a second plate until everybody's had their first plate, yeah. right? You go to the cookout, you eat your plate, but yeah. you don't overeat. And even Paul talks about that with some of the struggles in the church communities is, you know, don't come in and overeat and get drunk when there's poor people here, you know, be sober about making sure everybody has enough. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to go throughout this book and pull out some of those things that I think directly critique and apply to our situation. And those are two big ones, the debt issue and then obviously the commonality issue, luxury being part of it. But that's my very basic kind of definition of where I think the scriptures and the early church point in that direction. And I think I'm conscious that we're doing a constructive work, but I think for me, it's fairly clear that it does lead to a clear anti-capitalist political ethic that we should be struggling more directly with how do we build solidarity, how do we build alternative methods and models for life, and really recognizing that the power for change is collective. It's amongst all of us. We're not going to wait for a hero to save us. It's truly us, the body of Christ, the church, that can be on the forefront and should be on the forefront as a church to mobilize people around care for the neighbor and all of these things, and having more systemic critique as well. So sorry for the rant, but that was a little bit.
Well, that's great.
Definitely a tough question.
We're pro-rant on this podcast. Thank you.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could share, you've mentioned some of the elements, you know, of maybe some New Testament, early church foundations for a more just political economy. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, you know, in terms of capitalism, there is this notion of just getting as much as you can at the expense of your neighbor. It's like, unfortunately, that's just necessary, you know. But you also sort of one of the other sort of common sense ideas that's embedded in capitalism that you critique in your book is private property. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that, because I think that's one of those notions that seems obvious to us, you know, as a good, like, oh yeah, private property. If I own something, I should be able to do whatever I want with what I own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's an important term to define, because I think when we hear private property, you know, there's signs that are like private property, no trespassing, usually applied to like a home or farm. I try to clearly define it as, not just personal property. I guess I'd say that I distinguish between personal and private. So like the classic example is personal property is my toothbrush, whereas private property is the toothbrush factory. So I have every right to own toothbrush use my toothbrush, and nobody should share it. And I don't think any socialist or, you know, anti-capitalist will tell you that we should all share toothbrushes.
Share everything equally.
Right.
Even toothbrushes.
Even though, interesting enough, that was a myth that I don't know who exactly created, but supposedly about socialist societies, that they all shared their underwear or something. And it was this myth that was kind of a Cold War myth. But certainly nobody's asking for that. That doesn't sound fun. But when I'm critiquing private property in the capitalist sense, we're talking about the factory that creates huge amounts of products and all of that. And, you know, the kind of Catholic or not Catholic, capitalist, shade on the Catholics, love them. The capitalist, mythology around private property is usually that it's almost kind of functions as this like this founding myth of the way, the reason why things are this way is because this person started from nothing, worked really, really hard, and that's how they got up to X, Y, and Z. And I think a lot of people are becoming conscious, at least people that I talked to are a little bit more conscious now, that some of that mythology is made up and not necessarily true or greatly exaggerated. You know, the famous ones about Steve Jobs and his garage and all of this, but well, he had really connected father and he had a lot of capital to start with. And, you know, it does require this. And I've done some like small business stuff in the past. And the thing I quickly realized is in order to really make that big jump to something enormous, takes a lot of capital, it takes a lot of resources, and it takes a lot of kind of taking advantage of people too. And so recognizing that, that ultimately what wins out is the large, large conglomerates. And, you know, you see those charts about where your food comes from and how it's mostly owned by like one or two people or one or two big companies, and they make a ton of stuff and all of that. And so that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about private property. And it relates to that kind of dynamic I was describing before with capitalism, where it's this tension between social effort, social work, where we all labor towards something, but it gets funneled into private ownership.
Yeah.
And so that's really the big piece of the critique of private property. We're not talking about, you know, like I said, just owning stuff isn't the problem. It's owning the means of production that owns, that's able to make all of the stuff. And so nothing wrong with having an iPhone. There's the meme joke that goes around that's like, oh, socialism is when no iPhone, which isn't the reality. But it's the idea of owning the factory or owning this or that. And not that those factories should go away. That's part of the thing I was bringing up before, is how it's a period of history that actually has developed good things. And what we're talking about and pushing towards is resolving that tension into having these large, because centralization, to some extent, there's arguments about this, but I think centralization is actually a good thing because it is a little bit more efficient to some extent. But the problem is that centralization does not affect the fact that everybody benefits from it because we're more efficient and we're doing this and that. And so taking the value that's created by all and putting it back into the meeting of needs, into the good of everybody, is the goal of abolishing private property. And Marx and Engels in the Manifesto make this really interesting argument where they say that, you know, people get really upset when we talk about abolishing private property and coming to an end of it. But he says, in reality, it's the capitalist class that has abolished private property for almost everybody, because they own all of it. And we own basically none of it. I don't own a toothbrush factory, right. But I own a toothbrush, you know. And so it's like he makes a statement, is like, you know, it sounds radical to say abolish this, and it kind of comes back on leftists or anti-capitalists as a outrageous utopian dream. But their argument in that book is actually it's already been done away. It's taken out of your hands. You don't have private property actually in their strict definition of what it is, but the goal is then to push it of like, actually we should all own this thing that's now become private. And that's actually a return to the people of what's created. And so the what's the phrase, that all, you know, the value of all that's created belongs to the workers and not to the people that simply just own a thing. And so that's the dynamic, and that obviously has some tricky things in there as well, as terms of what that looks like, how that works and all that. But that's the theory, I guess, behind kind of the conversation around private property.
And now a word from a sponsor.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part?
Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Now at Verizon, we're locking in low prices for 3 years guaranteed on my plan. And you can get a single line for just $45 a month when you switch and bring your phone. That's our best price ever on unlimited welcome with autopay plus taxes and fees guaranteed for 3 years. Because at Verizon, we got you. Visit your local Indianapolis Verizon store today. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Price guarantee applies to then current base monthly rate. Additional terms and conditions apply.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
As we close, Stephen, if you could help us understand the way that a lot of us grew up in a capitalist society, like socialism is next to godlessness, right? But you mm-hmm. use socialism as the closest political economy we have in our world to obeying the teachings of Scripture. Could you help unpack that and cast vision for that?
Sure. For me, I definitely... Again, I want to be very clear that it's not the kingdom. Obviously, it's not the fulfillment of the kingdom. I think we get into serious trouble when we identify the two things as the same. The kingdom is beyond anything that we could create humanly. It's something that arrives by grace. It's a work of God. I think in the way that I've kind of portrayed that, I use the language of pointing, that the critique in the scriptures, the critique in the early church points in a particular direction. I don't think we'll get there with our efforts, because I think it's a work of grace to arrive at the kingdom. But I do think making concrete steps along that way is also an obligation. And so I mentioned Maltman earlier. Maltman's theology of hope kind of gives language to this for me, where he talks about eschatology being this hope that creates expectation and anticipation in us that spurs us into action. I think people talk about hope as this kind of absent-minded thing. So, yeah, I hope that happens. But for Maltman, he's using it in a very particular way, where he's suggesting that because we have this hope for a new heaven and a new earth, because we have hope for the kingdom of God, the struggles of our day are more... they're more stark to us. We can't reconcile ourselves to them. So we can't accept inequality because we know the kingdom of heaven is coming. We can't accept child hunger because we know the kingdom of heaven is coming. And we are pushing towards that. He has this beautiful line, I'll probably butcher it, where he says to some effect that when we have this hope, the chains that we're in begin to chafe. When we sense freedom on the horizon, it chafes. And so I think that balances between kind of the danger of utopianism and escapism, where we're not trying to say that this is some utopian dream that's going to fix everything in human nature and, you know, sin's just going to magically be gone when we achieve perfect socialism, perfect kingdom of God, because that's utopian. But it's also not escapist, where we then end up totally apathetic. Sorry, I'm missing the words here, where we just totally resign ourselves to whatever happens, happens. I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to escape the world one day and let it all burn. And so kind of between those is where I'm trying to aim, and to say that concrete steps, we should aim towards this. We're always going to be pilgrims on the way towards this. We're going to fail, but ultimately we should be failing kind of in this direction. Yeah. And so for me, that looks like developing some way to overcome the systems of capitalism as they are, not to fix them or reform them, but actually to revolutionize them and arrive at something new. And so that's why for me, and I like the language, Bart talks about this in the later half of his Church Dogmatics. He uses the language of parables of the kingdom, where they're kind of, he's kind of, I think he's basically just saying almost the same thing as an earlier figure who used signs of the kingdom. And so these aren't identified with the kingdom, but certainly are not. And so I would describe socialism in that way, that it's a parable of the kingdom. It's something that we should be concretely striving towards, but never making the mistake of thinking that it actually is the kingdom. And Bart actually develops this really interesting concept of sin. There's that famous Luther quote about sin boldly, but rejoiced in Christ all the more boldly. Bart kind of uses that and applies it to politics. He says, sin boldly in the political realm, make these kind of radical leaps, but ultimately rely that God's the one that will bring the kingdom. And so having this sense of recognizing that, you know, socialism isn't a perfect answer, but making the step to actually act for the sake of for the people that are struggling. And so it's kind of a pragmatic, I guess, call in that regard. And I think it's something that is extremely complicated. And that's why this book kind of launched or birthed out of another book that is aiming towards that more constructive step of we actually shouldn't just be anti-capitalist. We should actually push towards a more social democratic system or socialist system. And so that book's taking on a life of its own. It's taking forever to get finished, but that's sort of where I'm, some of the thoughts I'm thinking about towards that is, okay, what does that look like? How do we actually try to make concrete steps in that direction? And then obviously all of the endless questions that arrive, well, what about X, Y, and Z? What about this problem and all of those? And so it's extremely difficult, but that's kind of the basics of where I think with some of that stuff.
Well, Steve and I really appreciate this book and the sense that it's often hard to even question capitalism because of how closely it's associated with not only America, but also Christianity in America.
Right.
And the gift of your book is how you hold the scriptures and the early church witness up against sort of this myth of America that we live in and call us out of what I think is a deep syncretism between our political economy and our faith.
Sure.
And so for me, I think socialism is a good converse. I mean, socialism is one of the only protests against capitalism we have. It's one of the only pushes. It's the only thing pushing back against it. And so it helps us understand, get some distance from capitalism to rethink it. But then I think the scriptures and the early church fathers and hopefully this work you're doing can help help construct us a way forward, you know, like a positive way forward, not just a way to react against. So thanks so much for being here, man.
Yeah, no, thanks so much for having me.
The book, again, is called All Riches Come from Injustice, The Anti-Mammon Witness of the Early Church and Its Anti-Capitalist Relevance.
Well, that was fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like the cut of his jib.
Did ya?
I do. I did. Yeah, I don't know what accent that is. Yeah. No, I liked the cut of his jib. I find, you know, even the fact that, you know, he apologized for ranting, and I feel like I went on a rant. Anyway, it was a ranty podcast, which is fine. But I think the fact that that happened for me anyway just indicates my deep resonance with those kinds of ideas.
It's amazing how many, something we didn't get into that I really do commend this book to our listeners. There are so many passages from the scriptures that where God is directly lamenting ills and evils that are present in our political economy and directly commanding things that aren't present. And then you have all these passages from the church fathers about how they think about property, possessions, money, the earth. And one of the ways that mammon works, it's common in our world to think that mammon works by like infesting our hearts, you know, and getting us to love money.
Right. In a Scrooge McDuck kind of a way. Yeah. Or like the dragons, you know, of mythology, how they just love gold.
Yeah. Somebody sent me a little picture today of this woman at Mar-a-Lago. And there's this this life size, like, I don't know, it's like, looks like it's a couch size golden hoofed goat idol on display at Mar-a-Lago. And the idol is wrapped in $100 bills with Trump's visage on them that say, "In Trump we trust."
Is it real though?
And the idol's base says, "I love you," along with Trump's signature. Okay. Okay. The reason Ben, I'm gonna text this to you, and then you know, if you want to drop it in the show notes. I think a lot of us think of love of money like that. It's something that we feel like, as long as I don't create an idol out of money like that,
right?
You know, then I'm good. Then I'm good, right?
Yeah.
But what I notice is that, first of all, we can talk about how that's a deal that modernity made with Mammon, and but how the early church and the scriptures talk about idolatry of Mammon is way more concrete and material.
Yeah,
it's like Mammon wants to order your time, your relationships, your relationship to your possessions, your relationship to the earth, right?
Yeah.
How you treat people, you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I think we could use a good challenging from these scriptures and the church fathers, the way that Stephen puts them in this book, to help confront us with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's sometimes, I don't know, the way that people defend themselves against this, prophetic challenge from the scriptures and from the church fathers is sometimes to say, like, well, you know, the times were different back then, you know, times are different now. You know what I mean? We've got this different economy now. But they don't sort of take the step of saying, like, well, what kind of economy, I don't know, like, what kind of economy would actually accomplish the things that the scriptures and the early church say are good, you know? I think it's worth, there's some radical stuff. I pulled together a while back some quotes on, from St. Basil, the Great, on social justice stuff.
Yeah.
And it's just crazy, you know, how direct he is. Like Stephen mentioned this, one of his quotes, on the podcast, which was, you know, if you have two shirts, you know, you're stealing from the poor, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, like he says, for example, I just looked these up. The bread you are holding back is for the hungry. The clothes you keep put away are for the naked. The silver you keep buried in the earth is for the needy. You are thus guilty of injustice toward as many as you might have aided and did not. It's so challenging.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing that I think is important that he said that we lose sight of is so the two main pushbacks I get anytime I talk about Mammon is, one, well, what's your alternative? And then if you're like, well, we could do some kind of social democracy, people start calling you a communist. And then they're just done, right?
Yeah.
I have no desire to defend communism. Secondly, people will say, well, you realize that you're wealthier than 99% of the planet.
Right.
So if you're going to critique Elon Musk for being greedy, you're also condemning yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that retort in this conversation is part of how Mammon works.
Sure. But say more.
My relative wealth and my relative security is way more close to somebody living on the street than it is to Mark Zuckerberg living in his $100 million bunker underneath Hawaii. Meaning, Ben, you and I, if we went without a paycheck for 3 to 6 months, we would be in danger of losing our house.
Right.
We have relative relative income insecurity. And most of us, even most of us who think of themselves sort of in this middle class, we are 3 to 6 months of no job away from going into pretty bad debt.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not the case for the wealthy people that scripture condemns.
Well, that's an example of what Stephen was talking about, where, you know, we do have much more in common with, you know, people literally living on the streets. Just, you know, just doing the math. And that's a trick. I think you're right. That's a trick that Mammon plays on us, is to get us to think that we are in solidarity with the wealthy. Yes. When we're just not.
That's what I mean. Yeah. So one of the ways that capitalism remains hegemonic or maintains its regnancy or stays in power, mm-hmm. is that it seeks to break up any kind of solidarity among the poor.
Yes.
Who can call the rich to account.
Yes.
And one of the ways it does that is to blame the poor for their poverty. Mm-hmm. So that there's a lot of people walking around pointing at poor people and saying they're lazy. Mm-hmm. Another way it does that is it says, hey, Matt and Ben, you have way more in common with Elon Musk than the person who's homeless or unhoused.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And I think both of those things are mammon propaganda.
Mammonic.
They're mammonic.
They're mammonic. No, I think that's really good. I've had this little project in my mind that I might do just right now after we get off this podcast, mm-hmm. that I think might help to illustrate it. But I was thinking about a line, just a number line, from $0, the person in the most abject poverty you can think of, and then the richest person on earth, who I don't know who that is right now. Is that Elon mm-hmm. Musk now? And you just like put the dollar amount that they talk about for him, right? And you, on one end is zero and the other end is the richest person on earth. And then like you invite people to imagine like where are the poor on that number line?
Yeah.
Like where do you cut it off?
Yeah.
And to try to figure out like, because I think sometimes it's like we just don't have a concept of how enormous a billion is. Just 1 billion is right. absolutely enormous. It's right. it's just like we don't understand how huge it is. And so I think that we do sometimes think, oh yeah, I go on a nice vacation every year, therefore I'm wealthy. And it's like, no, you don't understand. You have yes. no clue how much closer you are to the poorest person. I mean, just yeah. massively closer. Anyway, I'd love to make that kind of time or that number line just to try to illustrate that. I think it might be helpful for me.
Yeah, because it goes beyond our comprehension, like how big the universe is or how small a quark is. Like it's just,
right.
you know, we can't fathom it.
Right. Yeah. And I think that Mammon then plays in that space of ignorance in our minds to trick us into thinking that we're in solidarity with Elon Musk.
Tricky Trickerson. Yes.
Because, you know, we have a home that's appreciating in value or going on a nice vacation or whatever. So anyway, this is more ranting happening here.
Well,
in the outro.
Yeah, I'm
just looking up a dad joke.
No.
Oh, okay.
No, Ben. I've picked up some very subtle cues that my dad jokes aren't appreciated.
Mm. You take your bat and your ball and your dad jokes and go home?
For most people, I think it takes one or two dad jokes to sense that. But for me and my neurodivergent brain, it took 83.
83, yeah. Mm-hmm. And now you're sure?
No, I'm not sure. I said they're very subtle. Not sure. And I'll probably roll out one later. But for now, For now, I'm very quietly and very privately pouting.
Pouting. Oh, I thought you were going to say taking up your cross and following Jesus.
Well, I am storing up in my silence. It's lacking for you, dear Christian.
Dear but, Christian listener.
Anyway.
Amen.
I don't want to talk about it, though. I don't want to talk about how I'm not appreciated.
Yeah. And how righteously you are bearing
I don't that. Want to talk about it, Ben. It's better mm-hmm. to not say anything.
I will honor that.
And keep it, just keep it private.
I will honor it.
Please honor my piety.
At this time.
All right, everybody. Whew. Yeah. Well, right. Until next time.
Until next time.
See you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast, and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect there with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith and spirituality and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. Finally, we would love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, you can go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.
Months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. 6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.